Welcome to Making Movies is Hard, a podcast about the everyday struggle of being an independent filmmaker. I'm Ulrich Purcell.
And I'm Timothy Plain.
So this week, we have another special guest, just like every week these days, it feels like. We've got David Sandwich on the show. Welcome, David.
Welcome. Thank you, everyone.
Now, we should probably tell everyone what David does. He's a sound mixer and a post-sound engineer. Is that what your title would be?
Sure. Yeah, like post-production sound, re-recording mixer, and then on set it would be sound mixer. So anything in post-sound.
Nice. Yeah, so we both know David because he did sound on a commercial that we all worked on together, right? Is that right? You did Tostitos?
I did. I was the sound mixer on set for the Tostitos spots.
That was a lot of fun. I remember one time where you heard some noise coming from like around the corner or like on the other lot or something, and it was like some music or something.
Oh, yeah. There's Mexican music in the background from the factory next door, slightly.
Yeah, and then I go around the corner, and then it's like this really disgusting yard where they like prep these taco trucks and food trucks and stuff. And there's like one guy, he's just like far, far in the back of the lot, like right next to where we are, with all the doors open on their car, just blasting music just as loud as they possibly can. And it took me a little while to convince him to turn it off, but he wasn't so bad.
We greatly appreciate it.
I feel like with every other department, the first AD is always kind of checking with them. Are we good? We good? We were good to roll. But sounds one department where you have to kind of like raise your hand and be like, hey, everyone, stop. Hold on. There's a plane or there's Mexican music next door. We got to fix this before we go on.
Yeah.
We just kind of assume that it's good unless you say otherwise, right?
Yeah, you definitely have to be proactive and not be too shy. You got to speak up. Because the best noise reduction in the world is to not record the problem if you can avoid it.
right.
Yeah, that's a valuable lesson. I remember the first film that I did, I think we pretty much just taped a microphone to the end of a broomstick. And yeah, it didn't work too well. And the guy who was mixing it was not happy.
He's just kind of like,
next time maybe you should get, you know, a professional recordist. And I was like, okay, yeah, that's a good idea. And the next movie I did, and it turned out so much better. And he came with all great gear and had his ears on everything. So it just turned out so much better in the end.
Mm-hmm. Nice. When I'm on set, whether I'm a producer or director, well, not usually when I'm a director, when I'm a producer or like an assistant director or something, I just tend to, whenever I hear anything, I just stare at the sound person, you know?
Yeah. Is he freaking out? Nope. Okay, good.
Yeah. And if they, you know, and usually they'll look at me and they'll be like, there'll be some sort of communication, you know, but I'm always like, oh, if they're not worried, I'm not worried. Basically, that's my way to go.
Yeah.
Although I feel like sound is the one thing that I always get nervous about because it's a little like shooting on film where the first time that you hear it is in post. Well, I guess you do playback sound, but it's, I don't know, for some reason, I don't feel like I know exactly what the sound is like until I'm in the edit room.
Yeah, I think it's different when you're on set. You usually have perhaps a comm tech, which is not the most highest fidelity way for the director and crew to listen to. And you really notice stuff more when you're not distracted by needing to direct and all the other pieces moving around on the set. So it's really about trusting the sound person and hoping they're working out a way for them to communicate ahead of time, whether through hand signals or if it's okay to interrupt. But it's good to let the sound person be as assertive as possible without slowing down the whole shoot, because it will make you much happier in post.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm always ready to call it if the sound person wants to, you know? And I think that's one of the reasons why I'm looking at them, is because, like, do we need to cut now? Like, is this a disaster? Like, did we get that line, you know? Like, that's always the question, which usually works out pretty well. And I feel like sometimes, like, if you're looking at the sound person as, like, a producer, AD, line producer, whatever it is, like, that empowers the sound person to, like, call it if they need to. Because, you know, or at least helps. I don't know if that's true. That's just me projecting. But I don't know. I feel like if it's not just a sound person by themselves, you know, flailing their hands, trying to get someone's attention. I think it usually works a little bit better.
Yeah, I definitely think it's very important to establish a little bit of a relationship before you actually start shooting with the AD and director, if possible, just so that there's some kind of agreement about communication beforehand, so the sound person can feel that they can be assertive as possible. For me, a lot of the time, since I do post sound, I'm sort of editing in my head on the fly, so I can usually tell if something is going to be used or not, or if the talent is like perhaps doing an interview and they're working out a thought, it's probably not worth stopping. If there's some, you know, car horn in the background while they're composing their thought, because we'll probably get it in a more concise soundbite after the thought is worked out. But if you're not sure, it's always good to speak up, because there's no real going back and do it again unless someone says something.
Right, exactly. And it's kind of frustrating, I think, from, DP director's perspective, if that, like, your whole take isn't usable and the sound person didn't say anything, you know? And it's like, oh, if it was really not usable, we should not have kept on going, you know?
Yeah.
Like, we don't have time for practices here, people, you know?
I think that's true. Although I've been on set where the directors have said, you know, let's, you know, try not to interrupt if there's a sound issue. They'll try and be aware of it themselves, and they'll try and get another take out of it or another answer to a question or whatever. But I think you need to, you know, hopefully get a sound person you can develop a relationship with and a level of trust, because you're, you know, that's usually one or maybe two people on a set, and you're trusting a huge part of the movie to them, you know, basically like half the movie. From what George Lucas says, that sound is 50%.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
So you're really hoping those one or two people are really, you know, being your ears for you, since there's so many other pieces on the set that you have to pay attention to as the director, AD, and then you got all the lighting and everything else. So, you know, it's a lot of trust to put in one or two people.
Yeah, totally. So I could keep on going with more questions, but I think we should just sort of back up a little bit and just have you give your 1 minute bio of like who you are, your background, how you got started in sound, and, you know, what kind of stuff you work on now.
Sure. Well, my name's David Sandwich, and I started in sound probably around like fifth or sixth grade. I got really lucky that the public schools in my hometown were just starting some audio video classes at the time. And so I did that, which was great. And then my junior high also had an audio video elective. So I was part of that class in junior high. And my local church did a huge amount of stuff in sound and video. So I got a lot of live sound experience and learning about equipment and working on sort of live shows. And then I naturally wanted to make videos. So I did a lot of video editing and filming with my friends. And then just gravitated towards wanting to make the videos sound better. And then you start buying equipment. And then sooner or later, you look around and you go, wow, I have a lot of computers and a lot of mics and a lot of stuff. And it just sort of accumulates over time. Eventually, I did go to San Francisco State, and I have a bachelor's degree in cinema, which was fantastic. I highly recommend the film school. I loved the whole experience there. It was great, great professors, and made great friends and great relationships that I still work with people today from SFSU.
Nice.
And right now, I do a lot of everything, I think. I do a lot of production sound for various corporate shoots, TV shoots, and docs. Not so much long form narrative feature film production sound for me, but I also do a lot of post sound. I like to introduce myself as like a post production sound person who's also doing production sound. So if I come from the next part of the process, hopefully that informs me better to do the production side of the process, because I know what's salvageable and workable in post. So I do everything now. I do a lot of radio commercials right now for Stanford that are playing in the Bay Area for Stanford Hospital. I've done spots that get played during, Warriors and Giants games. commercial spots for them as well. I've got one documentary in my computer right now that I'm doing notes on later today. It's going to be a feature length doc, and I've got several more in various stages of the pipeline above me. Plus, there's always little corporate videos to finish that go on YouTube or go out to TV or whatever. And I've done feature film post too. So it's kind of a mix of everything, and even some live sound along with streaming. I'll be doing that next week in Denver, streaming a corporate meeting all over the world for their employees to all watch at the same time. So I'll be doing live sound and streaming together.
Wow, man. Well, it seems like a lot of different things, you know, mostly posts, which is great because that's like the main thing we're going to talk to you about. Mm-hmm. But I'm curious, like, do you have any interest in doing feature films as a sound mixer, like on set?
Yeah, I do. I have done them before. The most recent one I did that was the biggest is called Unleashed. It has Kate Micucci in it and Sean Astin. He's from Lord of the Rings, and Kate Micucci, most people know her as Raj's first girlfriend on Big Bang Theory. Yeah, that was a lot of fun. It's just those days are really long, and my current kit is only so big, and feature films usually need a little bit more stuff, which I can totally get and have friends who have all that stuff. It's just a matter of, you know, time and budget and working it all out.
Right.
But if I were to do a feature film, I think everybody should have a boom op, because it's really, you know, much for one person to kind of manage, and it's super tiring to hold the boom plus all the other gear on your belly for like 10 to 12 hours. So, you know, a boom op is highly, highly worth it.
I have a question about different types of recording sound on set. Sure. And if there's a difference between documentary and TV and feature films. I've heard one of my mixer friends say that in TV, they tend to lav actors and have a boom, but in feature films, they tend to just boom them. Do you find that there's a difference between those, or is it all kind of starting to get mixed now? And, you know, kind of what are the different techniques that you've seen people use, and what seems to be the most successful to get you that like rich cinematic sound?
Well, I think the most important thing to remember when you're recording sound, whether it's on a feature film or TV or documentary, is that you're like shopping at the grocery store for all the ingredients that are going to be used in editorial. So from a post perspective, we're hoping that you give us as many ingredients as possible, so that we have as many options as possible to make the best, quote, meal as the chef that comes in post-production. so in thinking like that, I tend to like to lav and boom people, because you just don't know what will sound the best. A lot of times, if it's a two-camera shoot and you have one camera really wide, you can't really get the boom in as close as you want. Certainly, from a post perspective, I would always try to make the boom work first, especially for feature film. And I think in TV, too, certainly for, like, shows, if it's, like, a live news thing, you know, those are probably more lavs predominantly. But in general, I think most of my sound re-recording mixer friends at studios and editors would say that they would try to make the boom work if at all possible first. And then there's even tricks you can do if you use the boom and lav together. You know, you can use one to help out the other with special post-production techniques. So, you know, if you have the opportunity to record both, I think it's generally a good idea to do so.
Okay.
And then it just gives you more choices.
And is it fair to say that, like, the lav is going to give you more of, like, a present sound, and the boom might give you a little bit more room tone?
Yeah, but there's certainly cases where the boom will have less of the room than you think, because a lav is usually like an omni pattern, so it gets the voice as natural as possible. So it might pick up more sound in front of the actor and more sort of whatever room is in the background, and the boom is usually a tighter pattern, so it's kind of rejecting the sound behind it. The boom will usually sound richer and have a smoother tone for the voice and more low end. But each situation is different, and that's why you just don't know until you get there. And since sound people usually don't get to go to the location scout, you know, you just bring everything and hope you're prepared and be as prepared as possible.
That just reminds me. So I worked on a movie once as a additional boom op a few years ago, and I worked with a French sound mixer. And it was interesting because she had like, you know, eight plus lavs. And in certain scenes, she'd have a lav on every single person. And then she'd also have me and the other boom op booming as well. And, you know, going into that situation, I was like, it doesn't matter if I don't do perfect. Like, you know, they have eight lavs. It's no big deal. And then I remember her telling me like, no, I will not use any of the lavs. If I get perfect sound from the booms, I will not mix in any lavs. Lavs are not beautiful sound. It's an ugly sound from the lav, because she's French.
Interesting.
She's like, the only great, beautiful, lovely sound is from the booms. So don't, like, you have to be perfect. And I was like booming from like 20 feet away on one, just like with this long carbon fiber boom pole, and just doing a terrible job. I mean, doing my best, but you know.
Yeah, I guess because the lav mics are so tiny that they probably don't have the same range as like a boom mic, right?
Yeah, but I'm curious, David, what do you think about that? Like, do you prefer the shotgun mics to lavaliers, or is it just like you said, it completely depends on the situation?
Oh, I definitely prefer boom mics or any bigger mic to a small mic. It reminds me of when they did Les Miserables with the Hugh Jackman version. They did some tests beforehand between studio mics and lavalier mics. And shotgun mics in a studio to try and figure out the best way to capture sound, because they didn't want to do any ADR as much as possible. They wanted to capture the live performances on set and use them as the base to write the score around. So they decided that the best they could get the lav to sound out of all the ones they tested was about 60-70% the quality of the booms that we use on set.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
It's just it seems like a physics issue of like, you know, bigger diaphragm mic usually can get better, more natural sound. And it's, you know, probably in a better place to capture the voice than, you know, hidden on someone's chest underneath their shirt or blouse or wherever it is. If at all possible, I start with the boom and post, and all my friends tend to start with the boom and post as well.
And then just mix in the lavs as needed, basically?
Yeah, the lavs are like there. If I can't make a scene work with the boom, then I'll try making the scene work with the lav, and then, you know, see which one I can fix more problems in. I think it's more important to be consistent in post when you're cutting a scene. So I wouldn't do something where I like have the boom for 80% of the scene and then just switch to the lav for a couple lines, because you'll notice that the person will sound a little bit different, and so that's usually distracting to the audience. So consistency is more important a lot of times than having the perfect quality or the best quality for one or two lines and then having to sacrifice for the rest of the scene or whatever. But I think in post, it's important to realize that there are no real rules. There are lots of, you know, best practices and guidelines, but there's an exception to every rule. So, you know, it's very much a creative and fluid craft.
Nice. That's awesome.
Besides people's voices, is there anything else that you're miking on set? And what kind of mics do you use? Like, do you ever just throw a mic out there just to like capture background noise while the scene's going on?
Absolutely. I think, like I said, the more ingredients you can get at the supermarket of the set, the better it is to make the meal in post. a thing I like to do on set when I have the time to do it is I'll have the boom op out there with the various shotgun mics, and then I'll put up a stereo pair of what I use is Neumann Cam 140s. It'll be a stereo pair by my cart that's just kind of getting the ambience of the scene from a farther away perspective. And so And then in post-production, I'll try and use that sort of in the surround sound field, which gives the scene and the production sound a little bit more of a surround sound feel instead of just being so mono coming out from the center speaker only. And it also is a good thing to use as a starter to put through for reverb to kind of bring the scene a little bit more to life. It works really, really well indoors. It just makes you feel a little bit more part of the scene. If you can kind of get a much farther perspective that you can kind of use in the surround field to just bring that scene a little bit more to life and not feel so mono and isolated in the center of the screen, which is where dialogue normally comes out. And then you right. do things like add reverb and other things to try and make it a little bit more lush. It works probably better indoors where it's a little more sound controlled. It can work outdoors too, but outdoors sometimes there's just so much unwanted sound it doesn't right. work. But it's, you don't have to use it if you record it, but if you don't record it, you can't use it later.
Yeah. And then I know that we typically like to record room tone at the after we're wrapped and, or before we wrap and we move on to the next set. How important does that end up being when you're editing?
I think a good room tone track is really useful. You know, just during the editing process, you're constructing the scene, so there can be changes in sound between different takes. There can be usually end up being holes between someone's dialogue and the rest of the character's dialogue. So when you're editing, especially dialogue, you want to end up with one continuous sound for the scene. So wherever there's holes, you want to fill it with room tone, and room tone is the best place to get the audio from. You can also sometimes find it in silence between people's words, or maybe there's 5 seconds of silence after the clap of the slate before the director called action or something. So if you hunt around, you can usually find smaller sections, and then you can kind of artificially construct room tone out of that. But if you can get a nice 30-second room tone on set for each scene, that is golden. Very, very helpful in post.
Okay, cool. Isn't there anything else that we would want to capture on set before we move in with you into the post-production world?
Sure. If there's time, if you're doing a scene with a particular set of props that might be very hard to get later, it might be nice to just get some of those prop sounds as wild sounds. There's probably always something on set that the sound mixer could record that might be helpful in post. It really just comes down to, do you have the time to do it, and are you slowing up the rest of the shoot? You know, will the AD give you right. enough time? Or, you know, maybe while the crew all starts their lunch, you know, at base camp, maybe you can just quickly, you know, get a sound of a particular door that might be really hard to get later or something like that. But the you can usually find stuff that's hard to reproduce. I think a good example is on Prep School, which I guess you guys have talked about before, right, Oliver?
Yeah, absolutely.
So in Prep School, there's the big rugby scene at the beginning, and my friend Keenan and Dan Jasper did a great job recording and booming the sound on set. They got a whole bunch of just background wall of the crowd sitting in the stands without the camera running, which was super useful for me, as well as just like a bunch of wild takes of them just playing rugby, so that I could build layer upon layer upon layer and add to the sync sound and make the game and the crowd seem a little bit bigger and more lush and more consistent. So, you know, certainly things that take a lot of people, like having a crowd, if you have the people there on set, try and get a minute of them cheering, you know, different levels of how loud can they cheer? Are they clapping? Are they yelling or screaming? Because that's really hard to reproduce exactly later. And, you know, sound effects libraries are great, but it's never as good as like having the real thing in front of you and just recording it.
Yeah. Well, I mean, what do you do though when you have like one thing that you're missing? Let's say like, you know, Dan and the Keenan who, you know, who did the sound, like let's say they missed one aspect of the scene that you really wish you had the audio for. In that, if you have everything else recorded there on the spot except this one sound, whatever it may be, you don't have a clean version of it, what do you do? Do you go out and re-record it, or do you just, you're forced to go to a library?
I think it's, if you can go record it, that's usually the best option.
Yeah, what kind of movie is this, Ulrich? Is it a Marvel movie? Because if it is, we're re-recording it. If it's your movie, we're probably using a library sound.
So let's use Prep School as an example, because Prep School is probably, you know, it was a very independent production. I'm not sure how much budget you had, but I can't imagine it was much.
Right.
So like, let's use that. Like in that scenario, would you just do it on your own and not charge them? Or would you like go to the producer and be like, hey, I need like, you know, another $1,000 to go get this one sound?
I think a lot of times if it's just one or two things you need, I think I would just go out and do it on my own. Or in that case, I think I had the director, Sean, help me a lot. So I really had him help me record a bunch of sounds in post. So I put him to work. Since it was a low budget thing. And I think that's a nice way to keep the director involved. And, it's super educational too, for the more that the independent directors and people who are just starting out can see the post sound process. Cause as much as you learn in school, there's nothing like doing it for the first time on your movie and watching other people go through it, and then you'll know how to, you know, inform you on how to shoot your next movie better. So I think, I don't know, a lot of it is just searching through all the material that's recorded on set, and seeing if you can find any option there from an alternate take that might have the sound you want, whatever the thing is, or if you can re-record it, that's great. But sometimes you do just have to go to the library for speed and efficiency, because you don't have the time or budget to go out and go get every single sound again, because you would never finish the film.
Right, exactly. Sometimes you have to make sacrifices.
Yeah, and it's just about putting your time and effort into what will give you the most, the biggest bang for the buck. So it's a little bit like triage, where you're, you know, tackling the scene with like, what's the worst problem? How do we fix the worst problem? Then, you know, going down from there. And then I suppose there's always creative things that if you were given more time and budget, you would always do. I would think that's probably even true on huge blockbuster movies. You know, there's never enough time to really do every creative sound idea the post sound team comes up with. So it's really just about managing the process and getting you to the finish line.
Yeah, totally. I want to go back really quick to what you said earlier about the recording sound on a set and getting the room tone, but then if you don't have time to get the room tone, there's probably enough quiet spaces in there to make it work. Well, I just shot this sitcom a few weeks ago, and I said the exact same thing to the sound person when at the end of the day he asked for room tone.
Oh, all right.
I was like, you know, we got enough time, downtime in between. It's like, you know, we are already over our 12 hours, like, you know, 20 minutes. And I was just like, you know what? I want to get everyone out of here. Like, we just need to end this, you know? And now in my edit, it's like killing me, because, you know, I'm usually barking orders, or someone's whispering, or someone's walking, or there's just always something that's making it hard. So I've been able to make it work in this first episode. Like I'm just put the finishing touches on yesterday, but man, if I had 30 seconds of room tone, God, it would have been so much better.
Yeah, definitely. It gets used a lot, like you said, to cover up problems on set. Certainly people talking, extraneous sounds. Almost all the time I can construct enough room tone from a take. If there isn't a clean room tone track, I mean, it can do enough things in various pieces of software in the computer to create it and get me a long enough section, but it never beats just having the room tone recorded on set. And sometimes the room tone on set just doesn't work because, you know, when you're ready to do it, there's a plane going overhead or there's a train going by and you don't want to wait the extra 2 minutes for whatever the sound bogey is to clear. So, you know, we do have ways to make it in post artificially or capture it from the take on set and then construct it through various methods if needed, which happens a lot.
Yeah.
And sometimes it's as good as room tone may be, the actual sound in between lines during the take actually will match better. So, because maybe the mic's in a different position for room tone, or the person on set turned the mic's volume up or down so it doesn't quite match in volume. So, you know, usually the thing that works the absolute best to fix a problem is sound that's closest to where the problem is. So if you can find a clean section around the problem, then that usually will cover up the problem with the most cleanest, most invisible edit.
Cool. So Ulrich, should we head to the studio?
Yeah, absolutely.
I want to talk more about like long format stuff. And I'm going to set it up by just explaining how I broke up the Spirit Machine into sound elements, because it was about a 20-minute film. And I got some advice early on that I should break it into pieces and have different engineers work on it just to make the workload easier for somebody. So I gave all the dialogue to one person and he cleaned it up, sweetened it and mixed just the dialogue tracks. And then I gave the whole movie to somebody else to do all the background kind of ambience noise. And then I broke it into individual scenes and gave it to people to do sound design on. And then the final mix was done by one person. Is that a typical way that people are doing it? Or are they often just giving the whole project over to one person like you, David?
I think it's both. The ideal way is what you described, Timothy. It's usually about getting a small team together, and different people have different specialties. Some people are really great at cutting dialogue. Other people are really great at doing backgrounds or hard effects or sound design. It reminds me of some of the Avengers movies and some of the Star Wars movies that do it. Skywalker, they have specific sound editors who have specific strengths. So there's a specific person whenever you need like a magical sort of like mystical element that obviously can't be recorded on set. So they go to her when they want to have something sound designed that's very mystical. They go to other people when they want really great backgrounds, or other people might really be good at cars. So in post, as the when you're doing the sound supervisor's job, which is what I do a lot, you kind of learn what people on your team's strengths are, and then you just kind of leverage every person's strengths. That being said, there's also movies like Prep School where, like, I'm the only post-production sound person and I start with the OMF or AAF from the editor and I do the whole thing, from start to finish other than composing the music. And that's fine too. It just takes longer, a lot right. longer to do it by yourself, especially yeah. for something that's like 20 minutes to an hour to 2 hours. It yeah. takes weeks.
When you're doing a whole project by yourself, where do you start?
I think I always start with all the sound that the editor gives me from production. So I'll go through and organize it into different groups like sound effects, backgrounds, music elements, and dialogue that the editor has put in that were recorded on set, or other sound effects that the editor has put in from his library, his or her library, while editing the film, which is great. Gives me a good guide of what the editor and director were thinking during the editorial process. And then after it's all organized into my computer, I'll probably start with the dialogue, trying to make all the scenes as continuous as possible, make any notes about lines that just aren't salvageable, where I may need to go look for an alternate take of a word or two, or if ADR is needed, make an ADR spotting list. So usually I start with the dialogue first, because that gives me the foundation for everything else. And then I'll do backgrounds and sound effects and music and Foley after that. Cause, once I do the dialogue and see what was recorded on set, I'll have a better idea of what's left that I need. Cause I probably, oftentimes don't have the time or budget to just go find everything in a sound effects library, go out and re-record everything again from scratch, like every car, every prop or something like that. So, the more you can get from the set and salvage and make work, then the less you have to do in the other food groups if you're on a limited budget. So it's always good to start with the set first. And a lot of times if you're doing like Foley or other things, you'll have to give the other people a guide track of what you got on set. So if you can get that edited and cleaned up in the dialogue world, then that'll help the other parts, the other people in the sound process, do their jobs better.
Cool. And then you said you mentioned Skywalker Ranch. Do you work there sometimes?
Yeah, sometimes. I started going to Skywalker Sound, which is on the ranch. I think back in 2001, I had the opportunity to do a lot of music stuff with my sister's high school choir. So no picture, not a film, just music only on their scoring stage, which is fabulous. One of the 10 best stages in the room probably to record music in. And I've done lots of that since 2001. Usually go every year at least once or twice to do that. And then I've also started doing some stuff with picture now, which is what I, you know, love doing in post. So I've done a whole feature film with them, an independent feature film called Voca, that was shot in Iceland by mostly a Bay Area crew, and then posted here.
Oh, nice. Cool. And was the process on that film the same as prep school, where you did everything yourself, or did you have a small team that you're working with?
So for Boca, it's definitely more than just me. So I was the supervising sound editor, and so I managed the sound team. So it was me. I hired a Foley studio in Canada called Footsteps, which did a great job doing Foley for the film.
That's an awesome name for a Foley studio.
Yeah, Footsteps. I'm sure you can Google them and see them. They do lots of big films and commercials and TV shows. I managed the ADR. So I went to Wildwoods in LA and did ADR for the film there. So there's a small little team of people at each of those studios working for me. The composer was on his own and managed by the editor and director. So he did his own thing and then delivered me all the tracks for the film to cut in and mix. And then I had Skywalker do all the backgrounds and sound design and most of the hard effects. For this film in particular, is extremely challenging because for most of the film, there's just two people and no one else is around. So I needed someone with a giant library that was free of mankind for backgrounds so that it would maintain story continuity. And, you know, Skywalker's library is one of the best in the world. It's humongous.
Oh, I can only imagine.
So, you know, I could tell them, hey, you know, cut backgrounds for all these scenes and cover the film. And then, you know, you have to really make sure there's no mankind sounds, like, you know, airplane or a little car in the background or a little someone chatting, which for other films might be okay, but not for this one from story reasons. So, I just didn't have a big enough library in my house to do that. So I cut all the dialogue. I cut the Foley after they recorded it. I cut the ADR after the other studio recorded that. I did a little bit of hard effects recording. In the film, there's a very old, unique camera that gets used. So I did a sound effects session with my brother, performing all the various like shutter sounds and opening and closing the various latches and doors of the old film camera that's used in the film, and kind of built a library of that to cut into the film.
Wow.
And then I premixed my half. Skywalker premixed their half, and then we brought it to Skywalker for a final mix for a couple of weeks.
That sounds amazing. I mean, that sounds like a much more fun process than just sitting in a room by yourself doing an entire film.
Oh, it's definitely really fun to collaborate with other people because, you know, it's just good to get other ears on the film, and each person brings different strengths to the film, and it just enriches the process. As great as one person may be, if you can get a team of really talented people together, it just makes it that much better. And it's a huge amount of fun,
yeah,
to, you know, work with them at the studio, at all the various studios, and have like a team, and you're managing a budget and you're managing travel to various locations to do various things. But it was a blast. I had a great time.
That's cool. I've never done the Foley thing before. I mean, I've worked with sound designers that have a Foley room, but I've never like sent my film off or scenes off to be worked on. So when you work with someone like Footsteps, how does that happen? Do you get on the phone and brief them, or is there some sort of like sheet that you give them with time codes and tell them what you need at each of them?
Sure. Each studio is probably a little bit different. For Footsteps, I mean, all the studios will watch your film, and they kind of like shop it internally to the people who work there to see who is interested in doing it and who feels they can tackle it. So you send them your best work in progress, something that's fairly close to being completed, and then they review it. And then what I did for Footsteps was just sort of give them like a general spotting list for each reel. In post, we break the film up into 20-minute reels, if people don't know what that is, just so it's more manageable, because a two-hour feature film in the software that we use, Pro Tools, is just unwieldy. So there's a Google Doc for each reel, a big spreadsheet that kind of gives the beats of the reel and says, you know, like, hey, if you guys cover this, then, you know, I'll, you know, get this sound effect from, you know, a library or something. And then from there, Footsteps just kind of went and did the normal process of like clothing, feet, and props and hands, all the things the actors interact with as much as possible that are not things you get from a library or re-record somewhere else. So they didn't need too much direction. Other Foley studios want you to give them an exact list of everything you want, and then they just fill in all the pieces. So it just takes coordination. But I like giving the Foley team a little bit more flexibility and to have creativity. So if they think of something really cool that they want to try, I just let them to do it, because, you know, the more brains working on the project, the better it usually is.
Yeah, right. And then have you ever seen a movie that's like been released that didn't have Foley done, and could you tell the difference? Like what would a filmmaker be lacking if they didn't do Foley on their film?
I think most things that come out in the theater that you would see at your average local multiplex would probably have Foley in it. I think a lot of independent stuff and things you see at film festivals, especially lower budget prop stuff, probably doesn't have true Foley. And by when I say the word Foley, I'm meaning like someone is recording the clothing, the footsteps, the props and hands and things that people touch in sync while watching the picture in an actual studio. A lot of people sometimes just think they use Foley as like a catch-all term for adding sound effects and backgrounds and like getting some feet from a library, but I'm using it as the very specific studio process in this case. And it's expensive because it takes studio time and probably two or three people to do it, because you need an engineer and you need a Foley artist, at least two, and most of the time three or four people. So it's often on a very low budget thing. They don't usually get a studio to do Foley. And I think Foley really brings your film to life, because on set you can't record those really quiet details like people's footsteps really well. You can't usually get clothing really well. It kind of brings it to life and brings a certain level of like intimacy to the film. It's usually something most people have no idea they're listening to it until you like turn it off, and then you'll be like, oh wow, that's what it sounds like on the set. And when you turn off all the little things, but it makes a big difference. I think it's, if you can afford any amount of Foley, it's really, really important to do. It's probably one of the things that can help separate you from other lower budget independent films out there. If you can find any way to get a studio to do any amount of Foley for you, it just, you know, your eyes will be open once you see it. Once you have it done once, you'll never want to go back to not having it again.
Well, I've also heard bad Foley, though, too.
Have you?
Right?
Where?
Yeah, well, just in
name
movies.
Name some names.
I don't know. Netflix originals. yeah, I mean, I'll just be watching a movie and you'll just hear like just really like obvious Foley. And I think that's the worst kind of Foley, when it's obvious. Like it should be like seamless. Like it should feel like you're there. It should feel like you're in the space, and that, you know, there's no way that you could tell that that wasn't, you know, that didn't live with the video, the visual the whole time, right?
Absolutely. It's definitely something that's really, really hard to mix. It's essentially ADR for sound effects, right? Because it's you're replacing things or adding things to what was recorded on set, but you want to feel seamless with the scene. So it's really, really difficult to mix into the film. It takes a lot of little tricks, because usually in a studio you get really pristine, high fidelity recorded sound, and of course the stuff from the set has all kinds of sound issues, and the mic's probably not in the best position, so you do a lot of different tricks with EQs and volume, reverb a lot of times, way more reverb than people ever think gets added to it, because the studio is very dry and no real world environment is that dry.
Right.
A lot of it is sometimes Foley gets used on top of the production sounds. If you cut it into really, really tight sync with the on-set equivalent, let's say someone is picking up a piece of luggage, and if you have that as a Foley sound, and then you have that as the sound on set, a lot of times a blend of the two can be really good, and the Foley just kind of brings a little bit more fidelity to it, but it still feels like the set. So there's a lot of mixing tricks that get used. But yes, bad Foley can definitely stick out like bad ADR, and it definitely takes a talented person to mix it and time to do it to make it sit well. So you're right, it should be fairly seamless. Another good reason to do dialogue first is if you find that a scene is going to be partially ADR'd, it might be good to just ADR the whole scene for consistency. And then the Foley isn't trying to match a production thing on set also, so it gets a little bit easier to mix, because you're not trying to, you can kind of decide how the scene should sound a little bit more freely. You're not locked into kind of what the actual sound on the set was. But like I said before, there's a million reasons to do things differently in sound, and each scene is unique, so it just takes experimentation.
Nice. Whenever I think of Foley, I just think of a guy with coconuts in a booth making horse steps.
Sure. That's definitely one of the classic ones. Doing all the feet for animals and feet for people. That's what most people think of, is doing the feet.
Yeah. Oh, that's why Footsteps is a great name.
Yep.
All right.
Well, I wanted to just say that, have you seen that movie Blowout, David, with John Travolta, where he plays a sound guy, you know, is recording sound, Foley sound in the forest, and then he sees a car crash, and that's like the catalyst for the whole movie. Have you seen this?
I haven't seen that film, but it sounds interesting.
You should see it, man. It's like
it's like
a sound person's dream. Yeah, yeah. I think, but I don't know. I saw The Conversation after I saw that one, and Conversation is just, I don't know, that's exciting.
As okay, then it's like the sound version of Blow Up, the photographer mystery.
Right.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
There's Blow Up, too?
Yeah, oh, Blow Up and then Blow Out.
That's funny.
I think if people want a good recent example of like great, awesome sound design, I think everybody should go see A Quiet Place, which I believe comes out on DVD and digital today. So it might be available for download today. But that's a fantastic movie for like use of sound in story and great Foley and excellent ADR that fixed a lot of issues in that film. And just the whole way they use sound so integral to the story is just amazing to me. And it's done by Ethan Van Der Rijn is the sound supervisor, who is a graduate of SFSU's film school and used to do stuff at Skywalker, and now is down south, I believe, at Formosa Group in LA.
Oh, that's awesome. That's cool. I love that.
SFSU love. I didn't mention that I also went to SF State. So, you know, not the film program. I was in broadcasting, Becca, you know. Yeah. But still,
a lot of famous sound people like Christopher Boyes, who did Lord of the Rings and has a bunch of Oscars for that. He's from San Francisco State Cinema School.
Wow,
and Ethan Van Der Rijn. So
we have a lot of
famous famous behind the scenes audio people from that school, from our school.
That's awesome. Yeah, Timothy, did you see A Quiet Place?
No, I'm so bummed I didn't go see it in theaters.
Oh, man. That's
but
amazing.
Yeah, I'm dying to see it. So this will give me motivation to go watch it.
Yeah.
Yes, definitely watch it when you have time to really focus on it. I think it's just a great film. The aspects of it. Until recently, it was the 5th highest grossing movie of the year, behind all the superhero movies. I'm sure it's further down on the list now that the summer blockbusters came out, but it's done, you know, for a movie that cost, I think it was like $20 or $30 million to make, it's well over $150 million now.
No, that's it. $20 or $30 million. No big deal.
I think
deal.
So. When you look at the,
no, I know, I'm just joking. Cause we talk always about like $100,000 or $200,000 films on the on this podcast.
Yeah.
So like for us, $20 million.
But
is
it
like
was relatively low budget for like a bigger Hollywood thing. But,
yeah,
right.
It's done really well.
Especially a sci-fi movie with monsters and things. Like it's pretty low budget considering, you know, the amount of creature effects there are and action sequences.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. I think a lot of it is they really bring the monster to life with audio in a way that lets you like keep him off screen a little bit more so you don't have to have as many expensive visual effects. I mean, they really do some awesome things with the mix and surround sound to just kind of make you feel the creature. And it really shows you like the power that sound can have. It's not always what you see on the screen. It's like what you're hearing around you that gives you like an emotional, visceral response. And that's what makes sound so much fun for movies.
Yeah.
Nice.
And the use of silence. I know you have to go, but I just like that movie is so quiet and it's fitting for A Quiet Place. It should be quiet.
And there's actually
it's in the title.
Yeah. There's scenes in there where there's no room tone. There's nothing in the audio track, which is a bold, scary move for directors to do where there's no music, no sound effects. There's not even room tone or air tracks for some parts of the film. But it just works so beautifully with the story. Like that's what that moment in the story called for.
And
it was a very bold choice and it works fantastically.
I think the last movie, I'm sure I saw another movie since then, but the last movie I remember seeing where there's absolutely zero audio on the track was Contact, after that big loud opening and you get farther and farther from Earth and then it's just silence. And I remember sitting in the theater with the audience and they seemed so uncomfortable with it. We're like so used to being just like bombarded with noise. And when it's totally gone, it's like almost like people start fidgeting.
Yeah. Even in Star Wars Episode 8, they have a moment where there's no sound. I think it's after Laura Dern's character blows up the enemy ship.
And
I believe that I thought I read somewhere that theaters actually had to put up signs that said the film is not broken. There actually is, you know, a part where there's total silence because people are just so used to thinking that there's audio that the audience doesn't know what to do when there's no sound.
Yeah, at least have like a
it's great if you can make that bold choice and it supports the story. I mean, everything is really just driven by story and sound. We're not here to be flashy and take over the world. We're just here to serve a story like every other department in the film. The story has to be the king at the end of the day for anything you do, whether it's a feature film or some low budget corporate shoot. You know, the story is really the thing that's driving the medium for all departments.
Well, that's a great place to end on.
Yeah, totally.
So is there any place that some people can find you if they want to reach out or hire you for a job?
Sure. My website is sandwichsound.com. You can either spell my name correctly, which is sandwichsound.com, or if you just spell sandwichsound.com, it will go to the same place.
That's so smart.
Yes.
Awesome.
You have to get used to people misspelling my last name. So I got both URLs on purpose.
Yeah.
That's funny.
Well, especially with a name like Sandwich, it's like you just assume you know how to spell it.
Yeah. And it's great because people remember my name and it wasn't fun as a kid because I got teased a lot, but now it's really helps me out in my career because it makes me memorable and I stick out on a call sheet and I stick out on IMDb. So people remember the last name, which is good.
That's awesome. Well, thank you, David, for joining us. This was a great conversation.
Yeah. Thanks,
absolutely.
Man.
Happy to come out and do it again anytime.
Absolutely.
And everyone else, thanks for listening. And check out our website, makingmoviesishard.com, where you can find links to the things we talked about on this episode. You can also get in contact with us on Facebook and Twitter with the handle at MMIH Podcast. And check out our Facebook group. It's Indie Filmmakers Community, I think is what it's called. You can find a link to it on our Facebook page. And you can email us directly at podcast@makingmoviesishard.com. If you have questions or you can't find that Facebook page, we'll send you a link. And last thing is, if you like the show, please leave us a review on iTunes or Stitcher or wherever you find this podcast. It really helps get the word out. And that's our show for the week. We'll talk to you guys next week. Thanks again, Ulrich and David.
Thank you.